Right, today I am in London with Richard Haler, who is the MD of IBAS, the Independent Betting Adjudication Service. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Richard.
No problem.
You're also described as an alternative dispute resolution. So basically, you upscale existing disputes between punters and bookmakers. Firstly, why did you apply for a role that you knew would be confrontational every day?
Good question. First of all, I didn't think it'd be confrontational every day, and it isn't every day, but it can be some days. I applied for it because I love betting. I like gambling, but I love betting. And I'd worked in the greyhound racing industry and the horse racing industry before that. I know a fair bit about it. I like doing it myself. And the idea of trying to apply the principles of finding a fair resolution to problems that I'd used in the regulation of those sports to betting situations just really appealed. And I found it an interesting job from day one. Some frustrating situations, some rewarding ones, some sort of confusing ones, but always interesting. And I think that's reflected in our office. We have very few people who start work here and leave because it's just a job that changes every day and is always interesting.
Okay, you say you enjoy betting, etc. Can you give us a little bit about your background, just briefly, what you've done up to this point?
Okay, well, I haven't worked in the betting industry itself, but as I say, I worked in horse and greyhound racing. I always had an interest in betting. I think it's a bit genetic. Both my brothers are involved in racing or betting as well, and again, I've had an interest from a very young age. A bit of a horse owner, greyhound owner, but mainly enjoying trying to get an edge against bookmakers and enjoying bookmakers trying to get an edge against me.
Okay, so what would be, there's a panel that meets, I understand. So how often would that panel meet, and what would be the process when you are sorting out disputes?
Well, there's a panel of 16 adjudicators. There are 10 who've been in place for quite a while. We've appointed six new adjudicators, and we'll be formally announcing those in the very near future. And what happens is when a case arrives, so somebody who's got a complaint against their bookmaker or gambling operator, they fill a form in, normally on our website, but they can do it by post as well. It arrives here. One of our case managers looks at the dispute. First thing to work out whether it's something we can look at, because there are some types of dispute we can't look at for various reasons, and I can talk about those if you want, but if they can't look at it, they let the person know as soon as they can. And if we can look at it, they'll then bring together all the evidence they think that our adjudicators need to reach an informed and balanced decision. So that might mean going back to the person who had the complaint and asking for information about what they did and what they've already said and any records of emails with the company. And from the company, it might be about looking at the betting records, about the price histories of the thing they've bet on, or about their rules, or whatever it might be that's caused them to take the stance they've taken. When that file is put together, it goes to a number of panelists. It can be one or two if it's a very simple case, or a very repetitive case. We've had lots of similar cases. It might be five or six initially if it's quite a complex one. And then if it gets really difficult, if the panel just can't decide between them, there's no consensus being reached, and we put it on an agenda for a full meeting, up to 16 people sat around a long table, arguing, pointing, occasionally screaming, and trying to get a fair outcome. And in the end, if there's no consensus view reached on a case, it comes down to a majority vote of the panelists who are there. And some cases get really close sometimes.
Okay, I'm intrigued just briefly, what sort of disputes can you deal with?
Well, if there's, for example, an allegation of criminality, so somebody says that someone's hacked my account, say, or someone's stolen my money and bet with it and they want their money back. Some issues that relate to problem gambling, where people are saying they think the company's allowed them to gamble and the company's acted irresponsibly and they want their money back. There are some cases where we can look at that, but mostly we'd say that's a regulatory issue and they'd have to go to the Gambling Commission or the other appropriate regulator if it's from overseas to say they think the company has been irresponsible in the way they've treated that person. But we try to reach an adjudication on every case that we can.
Okay, and what would be the most common dispute you deal with?
It varies from time to time. So the big ones at the moment would be about the clarity of what betting markets mean. So these are where companies are trying to be innovative and come up with new betting ideas, but haven't really spelt out what the actual detailed terms of bet settlement are. Frequently, it's pricing errors. And we found that the more markets companies offer, the more pricing errors there are. I suppose you might say that's just a natural progression. But sometimes we feel that companies are churning out so much in-play betting material that they're not really monitoring whether the prices are accurate, and then are later making more adjustments than they did in the past, and citing what were once called palpable error rules or obvious error rules. And then a big trend recently has been from people who possibly don't understand or haven't had properly explained how the cash out mechanism works in bets, or cash in as some people call it. And that's recently in particular, we've had a lot of people who are frustrated that they're trying to cash out an accumulator that's been successful to a certain point, and the company is not offering them a value for it, and they believe that the company has said they're entitled to it, they can expect an offer at all times, but they're not being offered one, and they think it's unfair that they're being denied that. So it moves in trends. I think if you'd asked me a year ago, I'd have said the biggest issue was about unclear terms in bonus offers and welcome promotions, but as you might have known, there's been quite a lot of activity done by the Competition and Markets Authority looking into that, and the new requirements that have been published by the Gambling Commission for companies have helped cut down the number of cases of that nature, so that's quite good to see.
So how many disputes did you deal with last year?
I think we just had just over 8,000 requests for adjudication, and some of those, as I say, we weren't able to look at. We publish on our website and in our annual report the results of cases from UK citizens, because we are a UK regulated dispute resolution service. But of the 8,000, it's about 5,600 UK to the rest from around the world, and we get requests for adjudication from probably every country at some point or another.
Okay, but would you consider that to be a high figure or a low figure? Because I'm thinking 8,000 with the millions of transactions that take place every week or every month. What would your opinion of that be? Is it high or low?
It's tricky to say, because there isn't much to measure it against. I think if you look at other industries that have their own dispute resolution services or ombudsman, it's probably about normal. If you compared it to, say, the number of complaints about train companies or insurance providers or furniture delivery companies, they've all got their own ombudsman bodies, and you can compare those figures to other industries. But I think sometimes the way that gambling is portrayed externally as being untrustworthy is over-exaggerated. And that's something I've talked about in various presentations I've given and I've written about in this year's annual report that we published on our website. There are issues, and hopefully we're helping to deal with them. Hopefully the Gambling Commission is dealing with them. But I reject the idea that gambling today is untrustworthy, and it's been portrayed that way in lots of quarters, in Parliament and in the media in some places. I think that if you place a bet on something, you go back when that bet wins and you completely expect to get the winnings that you expect to get. You'd be shocked if you didn't get paid out on the winning bet and the way you understood it to be paid out. And that for me looks more like a generally trustworthy industry than a generally untrustworthy one. But I think the problem is that some trends, particularly relating to bonuses and special offers and account management issues and multiple account accusations and so on, have created the issue that trust is lower than it really is. But I think for the average person placing the average bet, I think they can completely expect to come back and get paid out just the way they would if their selection wins.
Okay, it's interesting you talking there, but you put a bet on and then when it wins you expect to go and get paid. There's been at least one incident I've been aware of recently where a punter has asked his friend to put a bet on for him because he can no longer get his bets on because he's been restricted. And then by association, the bookmakers refused to pay and just voided the bets and give him his money back. Now, what's the opinion on that sort of situation? It's always been like there's always been like odds to services. You know, I'll give you a tip. You put a tenner on for me, pay me at the price. What you know, have things changed as far as the rules go there?
Well, they probably have because the industry has changed. From our point of view, we know it's something that vexes lots of people, and I think there's some pretty strong arguments that have been made by individual punters about whether the way that they've been treated in those circumstances is being handled fairly and evenly. The way that we would look at it would be to start off with the company's rules or terms, and the question that's most often asked in those situations is it fair for a company to have a rule that says if you open an online betting account with us, you agree to be the only person who funds it, uses it and bets through it? And our panel have looked at that question quite a few times in different circumstances, and I think their view is that is a reasonable thing for a company to say. Now, from there, you go on to a different question of what happens if somebody doesn't adhere to that, and if there's clear evidence presented by a company to us that somebody has then passed their account to somebody else and they've used their computer or their iPhone or whatever it might be to place bets through that account, and the company is saying they want to enforce that rule. I think in most cases, unless there was a particular special reason why that was an unfair position for them to take, we'd say that was a reasonable rule for them to enforce. But the question that gets asked in reverse is, well, what would happen if those bets are lost? Would the company have made those same links? Would they have detected that account had been shared with somebody else? Would that person have got a refund? And it's an area that I think will be explored in further depth in the coming months. You know, that will, I think most people will be aware there's a quite high profile court case that's likely to come to public attention in the next few months. I know it's on the radar of the Gambling Commission as a regulatory issue, and I think there's a lot more to be debated about it. I know this will sound like passing the buck, but I do think it is something that it's a question that deserves either regulatory or legal attention. I don't think it's the sort of thing that an alternative dispute resolution body should be saying this practice is acceptable or unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So for the time being, I think we have to sit back and see what developments occur in regulation or in law, and maybe there are court cases on the horizon that will help us to understand the approach we should be taking to those sort of disputes.
So do you think that the bookmakers have created that environment for themselves? Because years ago only the very best punters would have been restricted or even had their accounts closed, and now you know you've only got to be moderately successful, just break even, and you're in that bracket. So you know, what were your feelings about that?
Well, I think to some extent they have created the problem by the way that the accounts have been promoted and the way that welcome bonuses have been offered and proliferated. And what you now have is situations where companies are with one hand trying to encourage customers in by offering them free credit up front, and on the other hand feverishly policing that, trying to make sure that somebody who's had one offer isn't entitled to another offer. And I think in the creation of that mechanism, they've applied that to people who bet from day to day, and they're possibly looking more closely than they ought to sometimes at people's betting patterns and spotting things that might not always be there. I think the issue alongside that is, and this is just through anecdotal evidence that I've encountered, is that I think there are examples of people who work in trading rooms who respond a bit impulsively and perhaps are too quickly to issues that maybe they've created for themselves. So to give an example, what I mean by that, a firm fails to suspend a betting market on a horse race, and the race goes off and it's a 6-furlong sprint, and 20 people who happen to be logged on at the time see the markets left open. They're watching on whatever racing channel showing it live. Horse X is about to win. They're 16-1. They have a 5 or 10 or £500, whatever it might be, on the horse. Then after the race, the trader who's managing that market sees what they've done. They see the 16 people who've done what they've done and say, right, boom, 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 down the list, cutting back to closing their account, no vessels guaranteed, whatever it might be. Now, I don't know how often that happens, but I get the impression that sort of stuff does happen. And one of the things that I've suggested to the industry in the opportunities I've had to talk to representatives about it is that there should at very least be some sort of independent calling off period within that company structure where somebody else who's not so emotionally involved with whatever the incident is, the palpable error, the offer, whatever it might be, can look at it and say, look, on balance, you know, this person's account, you know, they're just a customer who wins sometimes, loses sometimes, so you've gone in a bit too hard there, so ignore that recommendation. I'm not sure that control's in place in many companies, so I think sometimes people would have just one bet after a period of you know, up and down betting that will trigger some kind of an alert internally, and that alone will be the cause that loses them their bettors guarantee or whatever it might be, their right to offers, their ability to get the stakes when they want to get. And I think companies can overreact sometimes to that. But I should say that IBAS isn't empowered to make decisions on that. We're not empowered, I don't think, unless the Gambling Commission or other authorities tell us otherwise, to start telling companies you must lay a certain bet to a certain person. I think a bookmaker has always had the right to refuse a bet, and I don't think it's unlawful for them to retain that. So as much as it's frustrating for punters to not be able to get the bets on they want, I don't think it's an issue that IBAS can adjudicate that, yes, you know, retrospectively they should have that bet reinstated, or even look into the future, they should be allowed to have their bettors guarantee back. I think that has to remain the company's prerogative, again, until any kind of regulatory changes come about. But I do think companies could look at it more closely than they do. And I'm encouraged to see that there is more punter bookmaker dialogue going on about that now. And hopefully companies will increasingly be willing to look at correspondence from people who have had their accounts restricted or lost offers to be able to review whether that was done fairly and whether there might be scope to give them a second chance or whatever it might be.
Okay, so they've had the bet, the race is run purely straight, then the bookmakers had suspicions that they've been put in by a better punter. Should that bet stand or not?
But they've got suspicions it should be.
It's won, they think, oh, hang on, this is so-and-so's mate. You know, he's probably put them into me. Can they avoid those bets?
Not based on that suspicion. There has to be some evidence for it. You know, we've had various disputes over the years with various degrees of evidence, and decisions we will take, our panelists will take, are based on the quality of the evidence that's put forward. One of the trends, it's not in betting, not in racing, one of the trends that we've seen quite recently is online casino operators saying that they believe that various people are linked because they're playing to the same strategy, so they're accepting a bonus, for example, and they're playing the same slot game using the same strategy, and it's one that they believe over a period of time, if they use the bonus shrewdly, sees that person making consistent profit, and they will say, we believe these people must be linked because it's so unlikely that all these people could choose to play this same game and choose to play it the same way. And we'll say, well, we could see why you're saying that, but we don't believe that following advice is reasonable grounds to avoid bets. You can't say that someone is linked to somebody else just because they've done the same thing. But as I said before, if there is a concrete link to somebody else, you know, if they're using the same debit card to deposit or the same computer to place the bets, then it's a stronger case on the company's part. So you look at each case on its evidence and judge its own merits.
Sounds a bit rich for the casino operator to be complaining that somebody was too clever for them.
Well, there's a lot of irony in the submissions we see from punters and bookmakers. You know, so, as I said in an earlier question, you know, this whole idea that there should be recreational people and non-recreational people. Well, the gambling world attracts people who are looking to make money from it, and if companies can't accept that, then they probably shouldn't be in the industry.
Okay, so just for an example, Richard, you've got a punter that's coming to you and he's screaming the place down because the bookmaker's done him wrong. You start looking at the situation and you think, hang on a minute, this guy looks to be definitely at it. Would you be obliged to keep pursuing his case and investigate it, or would you at some point say, look, mate, you know, you're obviously trying it on, we're no longer going to deal with, you know, help you out with this? Does that ever happen?
Well, first of all, you don't often see anything instantly that makes you think that someone's trying it on. If you do, it's normally a shot bet. So you'll see a way a bet's been written out and you'll think, oh, it's all over the place. There are some common styles of writing very ambiguous bets, and when you see them, you see them instantly. So there's a clause in our T's and C's that's standard to every dispute resolution body in the country, whether it's in gambling or any other sector, that says you're entitled to refuse a dispute that is vexatious or frivolous. And if a dispute just has no merit at all, then we can kick it out before we even start looking at it. But my inclination has always been to look as far as we can at every dispute, because you never know. Sometimes when you dig around, you find that there's something to be looked at. So for example, if somebody has written out a bet in a shop that's written ambiguously, you might want to say to the company, well, if this person does it regularly, can you show me examples of it? And can you show me it's been treated consistently? Because what wouldn't be acceptable would be that another bet's written in the same way and was settled as a loser, and then the next one's written in the same manner and that's made void. You know, you've either got to void them all or treat them as winners and losers. So there's often something to look at. So it's generally when you dig the deepest that you find the most interesting parts of the story, and sometimes that reflects badly on one party or the other. We've seen both over the years.
So what would be the worst cases that you've had to deal with from both sides? What are the punters and bookmakers that have been in the wrong but have tried to defend what they've done?
I think different people would answer that in different ways. I mean, if I asked all members of our panel, the 10 who've been here for the longest, I think they'd all give you different answers. There are some that amuse me with the barefaced cheek of the claim. So in terms of punters, there was somebody who came, he was up in arms, and he said, you know, this particular company has closed my account, and they say that I've had multiple accounts with multiple welcome bonuses, and it's not true, this is my only account, I'm the only one who lives at this address, nobody else could have possibly used my computer, I demand payment of winnings. And when we looked into it, this particular punter had opened up something like 200 accounts, and in each account he'd changed one character in either his name, his address, or postcode, or phone number. He found this particular company's systems, and this was a few years back, were not very sophisticated, and any changes would allow a new account to be opened. And all of his accounts were the name of a footballer and their squad number, and he'd opened an account in the name of everyone in the Man United squad, the Arsenal squad, the Liverpool squad, the Chelsea squad, the Real Madrid squad, the Barcelona, and he'd just done it systematically down the list, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it was so cheeky that you couldn't help but admire it. So you get some of those sort of things sometimes. In terms of the worst responses from gambling operators, I think the lowest ebb is a more general one, and that was when casino bonus terms became the most complex that they came, which was about a year and a half ago. So I remember going right back, I'd to say about 2003, 2004, and online casinos are getting going, and you used to have to send off for a CD-ROM, and you get the software and load it into your computer, and you play blackjack or roulette through this CD on your home computer through a dial-up link. And at that stage, you would get, if you put £50 in, they'd give you £50, and all you had to do was gamble it once, and you could withdraw the money, and people were making huge amounts of cash out of it. I knew lots of people who were saying, you've got to sign up for this. It didn't appeal to me because I wanted to keep any accounts I had for betting. I didn't want to, you know, ruin it for the sake of a quick 50 quid, but lots of people were doing it. And so the companies changed it from being once to twice to four times to eight times to 16 times. And then you get to a stage, you know, a couple of years ago where companies are saying, put £100 in, £10 in, £500 in some cases, get a match deposit bonus. You can play these three games and you have to play them with a maximum stake of £5, a minimum stake of 50p. You can only win X times the amount of your bonus. Any bets placed above this level will invalidate the whole bonus. And the list of clauses would go on and on. And that, well, they wouldn't necessarily be unfair clauses, but they'd be so difficult to read. And with a couple of companies, we quite high profile ones, we found that some of the most important clauses were right down at the very bottom of the list. So for example, it might say right at the bottom of a list of 50 clauses, anyone who deposits using PayPal invalidates it, can't take part in the offer. And you think, well, that's you should be told that when you try and make the deposit from PayPal. It should flash up and say you can't have the bonus of it. But yet that was being allowed, and then people are then spending hours playing these games and then getting to the end and then finally being told, oh, sorry, you can't withdraw anything. So I think the industry got lost in that period, and I'm glad that a body with the clout of the CMA took it on and looked at it, and I think has come up with things that both the industry and punters by and large would accept are now reasonable standards of how those offers are policed. I still don't like the offers, for what it's worth. I still find the whole concept of upfront welcome bonuses very frustrating, because they still cause problems. They still cause arguments about who's actually getting the bonus and who's controlling the account. And if I could have one wish for online gambling, it would be to do away with it. But it's not going to happen, because everyone does it. And if everyone else stops, someone else will start. And it's, I think it's just here for good. But it causes us a disproportionate amount of bother for the benefit it seems to bring punters and bookmakers.
You're talking about ambiguous betting slips. So if you found like a serial offender, would you upscale to the police?
We wouldn't know. That's a company's job. If they think someone's defrauded them, they should report that to the police. And it works both ways. If a punter comes to us and they have evidence that their account's been breached, their bank account or their betting account, again, that's for them to refer to the police. But we occasionally wrestle with the dilemma of what happens if we see somebody taking the same approach to one bookmaker they've taken to another. And actually, we're looking at that at the moment from a responsible gambling point of view. So what happens if you've self-excluded with bookmaker A, and then you come to us with bookmaker B and you have a gambling dispute? Should we be saying something? You know, because we know it's the same person. We keep a light record of every dispute we've ever looked at. So we know it's the same person. We know that from one company they wanted to be excluded from gambling. Here they are betting with another one. Oh, should we be saying something to either the company or the person about, are you sure you want to be doing this? Because you want to be responsible as well as the rest of the industry is being. But our approach has always been to look at everything in isolation and not to share that with any other party. But it does, it weighs on you a bit sometimes, because you don't like to see somebody either getting into trouble because they're gambling excessively through different companies, or somebody getting away with the same trick in lots of places. If it's a strategy, fine. But if it's what might be called a fraud, you don't like seeing it being carried out in lots of places. But we don't share that, and we treat each case individually.
Okay, there's quite a few, in inverted commas, punters' rights groups out there, quite vocal, you know, criticising bookmakers and sort of looking for changes. Often because of, you know, people falling into problem gambling, which is obviously quite right. But do you think a lot of these groups will not stop? They'll keep moving the goalposts until bookmaking's outlawed? Do you think there's an agenda?
I think that everybody who speaks either personally or on behalf of others of criticisms about the industry has different motivations behind it. And there are certainly some people who would like to see gambling banned altogether, but some people like to see everything banned, I think. I think there are some people who probably don't realise that things they're saying to highlight particular concerns are fueling the fire of people who'd like to see gambling banned. But I don't think there's a particularly... I don't think there's a great strength to that lobby. I think betting and gambling is part of the fabric of certainly British society. And I hope that the problems that people who've got complaints about individual companies are raising either to us or to the media or to regulators or wherever it might be, only serve to make the industry operate in a more open and fairer manner. So maybe some people out there will not stop until much more dramatic changes happen. But I think the industry is fairly safe in that sense. The most important thing from our point of view is that if people are going to make criticisms, they're valid criticisms. And sometimes we have seen or heard of examples where people have fabricated stories or people have said they've brought cases to IBAS and had outcomes from IBAS that have just never happened. We've never seen the case. It's not anything we know about. And so you do worry sometimes that what people might see that and react to it and make judgments on it when there's no merit to it at all.
Okay, there's a lot more regulation these days. Do you think it's gone past the point of regulation to imposition now where bookmakers do their business?
That's for the industry to answer, really. In terms of regulation of dispute resolution, there's been quite a lot published by the Gambling Commission about how that sector works, how the sector we're in works, and I don't think IBAS has agreed with everything the Commission's concluded, but I think we agree that the path they're working down is the right one, trying to make a dispute resolution effective. I think if I had one concern about the approach the regulators are taking, it's that sometimes what they're telling operators to do isn't specific enough. There's quite a lot of generality to it. Be fairer, be more reasonable. But what would maybe be more helpful would be specific examples of this type of situation. The regulatory view is that you should do this. And I think that would be more helpful if there was a bit more of that.
One of the things that keeps popping up from time to time, seems to be more regularly than it should, actual racecourse errors. So racecourses have announced one horse is the winner and it's transpired that it's not. Racecourse bookmakers have paid out over both results. Then it seems that punters appear to have double standards. If they expect a double result if the mistake's gone the other way, but very few, especially racecourse bookies, they won't return the money if they've been paid in error. Now, should racecourse bookmakers expect people to return the money in error? And if they actually know about a punter that has drawn, you know, can they come to you and say, should they pay it back?
Okay, interesting question. I'm going to divert away from it and then come back to it.
Okay.
So it's not just racing. We get complaints about things like football matches where the whistle's blown early and then the governing body of the whatever it might be, Peruvian League, has had to decide whether the official result stands or whether it doesn't. So there are errors in everything. Every in sports administration, there are errors, and they create disputes. And so in racing, you sometimes get wrong results called, and you get those identified at different times. So going back a few months, there was a situation where a BHA inquiry reversed an official result, a weighed-in result, because they accepted that the judge made an error. And we had 40 or 50 people write in saying, well, surely I should get paid now on that bet. And our position was, well, the rule is that payments made on the official result at the weigh-in, that was the official result at the weigh-in. You can't hold the bookmaker responsible for that mistake. So even though you've been very unlucky, there's a parallel group of people who've been equally lucky, and we can't say that you should now be paid. Maybe you could write to the people who got paid out luckily and ask if they'd send their winnings over to you. I don't know. But we can't go in and say there should be double payment. In situations where a result is corrected on the day, what happens with racecourse bookmakers is probably a Tattersalls committee issue. So I might send you back to a Tattersalls committee rather than looking at it ourselves. But I'm concerned about the way that those situations are sometimes dealt with. I'm surprised, first of all. I'm not a regular Twitter user. I don't delve into social media that often, but I sometimes do when a big incident's occurred or a notable incident's occurred, and the degree of disgust that people have that they've not been paid on the incorrectly called winner or they've had their money taken back is disproportionate. You know, it's an absolute disgrace that Company X hasn't paid me. They announced that. I had every reason to believe that I'd won, and they've taken the money back from my account. This is disgusting. Bookmaker X has paid both people and you should too, and if you don't pay me out on the original announced winner, I'll never bet with you ever again. And it, that seems a bit over the top, but some of that is fueled by the way it's portrayed, and in when these incidents happen on television, particularly terrestrial TV as opposed to specialist racing channels, the messages that sometimes come through are quite confused. So the last incident that I saw, and this is, you know, I'm as you can tell, I'm no natural broadcaster, and I don't envy people who are in front of a camera live and having to talk about everything they see, but the last broadcast I saw where that occurred, the broadcaster said, bookmakers A, B and C have said they're going to pay on both results, good on them, and let's hope that others follow. And then paused and said, and of course we have sympathy for the on-course bookmakers, who many of whom have ended up having to pay out on both outcomes. And you look at those two statements side by side, and that creates a mixed message. You know, is it right for the off-course bookmakers to have had to pay on both results, but wrong for the on-course bookmakers to have paid on both? Surely one is right or the other. Or you praise the generosity, if you want to, of the companies who've paid out on both, but recognise that they didn't have to do it. But if you say those things in the way they're said, that does contribute to the growing public view that companies aren't doing it out of goodwill gesture, they're doing it because they're obliged to do it. And that in turn creates more unhappiness down the line. And I've said to various people in various operators that from our perspective, it's much more important to provide people with good, clear, knowledgeable customer service, people who understand the bet, can empathise with the punter and talk to them about it clearly and with authority, than it is to do occasional goodwill gestures that might cost the company the same amount of money. Because if you do that, there's an expectation built up that they'll do it next time as well. And then when they don't do it next time, that becomes a dispute that comes to IBAS. So somebody will say, last time they called two results, my bookmaker paid me, and they're not doing it this time, and that's not fair, and I want payment on it. And I think sometimes these so-called goodwill gestures actually end up creating more future problems than they solve.
Yeah, the culture of justice payments. Now, one of the things recently, I mean, the whole backbone of the bookmaking industry is trust. You have your bet, the bet wins, the bookmaker pays.
Yep.
Betbright, what's happened there, surely is something that just cannot be accepted as a legitimate way to fold up a bookmaker's business. I mean, what are your opinions on that? And can punters that maybe had anti-post bets that would have won come to you and, you know, try and sort something out there? What is your opinion on that? Because I'm furious about it.
Well, it's difficult because some of those cases are live, and our position has always been not to talk about live disputes. It's also complicated because this has been looked at by the industry regulators, and they've made their position clear that they believe, on the balance of the evidence they've seen, that the company has taken a course of action that was, I think they described as being the best one available. I haven't seen that evidence, and our powers as an ADR body to request that evidence are less than the regulators would be. So I suspect I won't be privy to some of the things that have been seen already. I suspect what will happen is that we will have to decide that we can't look at those disputes, because if something has been considered by a regulator, we are below the Gambling Commission in the hierarchy of decision making, with probably the courts at the top. So it's probably that if anybody wants to challenge that outcome, they'll end up having to take it to court. That's an option that's always open to every punter. If they don't like an IBAS decision, by the way, that people can always go to court. What has changed, though, that might be significant, is that in the 2015 Consumer Rights Act, measures were introduced that allowed people to combine together to bring legal action collectively, a class action, as they call it in America. So it might be that people who feel they've been treated unfairly in the way that company has voided bets that were looking to be in promising positions could maybe look at working together to see and seek legal advice on whether that's something they could challenge collectively. I agree with you that voiding open bets damages trust in the industry. In most cases, as most people will know, if a company surrenders its gambling license, they do it because they run out of money, and then there's not a great deal that anyone can do for anyone. But other companies have handled it better, and you know, I'm not saying this just to promote them, but SunBets closed down last year. They had a 6-month winding down period. They allowed every bet that was settled in that period to be settled, and any that wasn't, they offered a cash out value for. And we had very few complaints. We had one complaint from somebody who had backed Donald Trump to win the US election and the US to declare war on Mexico. And he said that as that bet had half won, he should be paid half his winnings at the price of 100-1. And we didn't necessarily agree with that point of view. But the company offered him a cash out value that was, in our view, very generous, 3 times the price of Trump winning the election. And there is a better and a worse way to wind up an online bookmaking business. But I should say again that the Gambling Commission looked at this and they've seen things that I haven't seen. So I can only take on trust that they've seen what they need to see to reach a decision that the company has acted in the way they have was a reasonable thing to do.
Okay. What would you describe as the most frustrating part of your job?
That's difficult. I give a different answer to that all the time. I think there are two things I'd say, different types of things. The first is when we are misportrayed by people who either intentionally or accidentally misportray how we work. I've read articles written about the IBAS service in some publications which have referred to the way we go about doing our work that just aren't true, or referred to cases that I don't know about, and those people haven't ever come to us to say, you know, can we ask about a particular case. They haven't asked for any background information from us, and that's frustrating, because I think what we're here to do is to provide an alternative to court action, an informed, free of charge service that people aren't obliged to use, but saves them the cost and hassle of going to court. And I think the service we offer is pretty good, and I think we've generated lots of positive outcomes for thousands of contented punters who've complained to us. So when someone wants to be critical of what we've done, I think they need to be critical about a specific thing. If they're just generally critical, I think that's unfair. So I think that's frustrating. And the other thing that I find frustrating is when you've gone into bat for someone who's come to you, who's made what just reads like a really plausible case, and you've gone through a process, you've asked the company lots of questions because this person made a particularly good point, and you're saying to the company, yes, but I'm going to dig deeper on that and deeper on that. And then something emerges at the end and they come back and say, oh, by the way, I didn't tell you that. And you think that you've wasted a lot of time on somebody who knew from the start that there was no merit to their claim at all, but didn't disclose something that was vital. And you just wish you'd spent that time on someone else. You know, people phone this office all the time saying, when's my dispute going to be done? And most get done in a pretty sharp timescale, but the ones that are more complex can take quite a long time. And if you waste some of that time on a case that really, when you see it, had no merit at all, you think that's just a shame that someone else has had to get less of our attention to help that person who didn't deserve it.
Now, one of the things I was very surprised about when I did my research is that your findings are binding for operators up to £10,000, but non-binding for customers.
Yes.
Now, you know, surely, but for that's unfair for starters. And also, wouldn't it give a no-lose sort of carte blanche green light to the rhino skin punters that might try it on?
Well, it's law, so there's no escaping from it. It's the law at the moment anyway, because it's an EU law. So the European Directive on Alternative Dispute Resolution came into force in 2015, and it was introduced into British Parliament at the same time. And you can read those ADR regulations, they're available. If you Google them, you can see what we're meant to do and how we're meant to do it. But every dispute resolution service in every European Union member state is adjudicating to the same broad standards, and they are that your decision is binding on the company but not on the consumer. Now, the Gambling Commission has added a bit of a nuance to that in putting this £10,000 upper limit on the company, and that reflects the financial thresholds of where a county court decision would possibly progress to a high court decision. So if we find against a company up to £10,000, that's the equivalent to a sort of county court outcome. That is binding on the company. But if the value of what we're awarding a customer exceeds that, the Gambling Commission believes, and we agree, that the company should say, well, this case needs to be tested at a higher court. The authorities, or it, the evidence needs to be heard in greater depth. And we don't offer that service. Everything we do is conducted in writing. We would accept video evidence and things like that, but everything we do is done through email exchange and in the written word. So if there's a case that justifies a face-to-face hearing, and sometimes these are lower value cases too, where the company says that happened and the individual says that happened, and there's no substantial evidence to say which one's telling the truth, you might say to them, well, this is a case that really needs court attention, and we think anything that has a value over £10,000 could theoretically need that court time and need cross-examination of the two parties.
Okay, finally, as a footnote, is there anything that you would like to see improved, changed, to make your job easier?
Well, I'm not necessarily to make the job easier. I think the Gambling Commission is currently reviewing the number of dispute resolution services there are that offer gambling adjudication. And there's an argument for saying that there are more than there need to be, and that can possibly be either confusing for customers or allow companies to shop around and find the one they think best suits their needs. So I think that it'll be interesting to see the outcome of that work and see whether there are fewer in the future. I think that would be good if there were. If I had to give a list of the things I would like to see the industry do different, it would be a list I'd never stop running through. And punters will always be punters. You know, there are more conscientious ones, less conscientious ones. We see them all. In the end, betting and gambling is about two people trying to win money off each other. And for that reason, there'll always be people who don't tell you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Brilliant. Richard Haler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can follow Star Sports on Twitter at StarSports_bet, our Facebook page at StarSportsBet, and also view all our latest videos on YouTube at Star Sports. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.